Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I had with co-founder and CEO of Box, Aaron Levy. We cover a bunch of ground related to the state of the enterprise today and what he and his customers are thinking about artificial intelligence. We talk through a bunch of different topics related to AI, what different people should be thinking about, his views on closed source versus open source and the opportunity that presents going forward, as well as some of the considerations related to the business model change that seems to be occurring with usage-based pricing. A really fun conversation that you'll hear with Aaron now. Aaron, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
What in your mind is a model company in today's parlance as we sit here, you know, March of 2025?
Wow. Okay. That's just jumping right in. What is a model company? Well, I mean, I don't think you actually even have many model-only companies. And so maybe the only distinction is you have companies that have models and then other things. So if I'm being like extremely technical, technical about the definition, there's probably not that many like model companies. I think you have AI product companies that have research divisions that you know build models and then they have APIs into those models. Probably to this point, like it's like Mistral is probably the only, you know, like true model company where most, you know, OpenAI, I would not call a model company. I wouldn't call Anthropic a model company. I'd say those are, you know, AI foundation frontier lab companies that have products and models and services and just like all the things.
Do you think that serving enterprises with some type of model offering, but ultimately selling whatever the core things that enterprises mostly buy, do you think a company can build long-term value around that? Or do you think that will ultimately, whatever that is, resides within an AWS or a Microsoft Azure or a GCP or something like that?
I think it would be hard to underwrite that alone as a massive business because you basically are dealing with this issue where all of the hyperscalers at a minimum, and then a few other companies that aren't kind of natural hyperscalers, but they have adjacent enough to the hyperscalers, like they need to make sure their models get used at an unbelievable scale. And because they have to win an infrastructure war, they need the compute to come to them. They have other software they have to sell. So it is so existential to them to have their models get used at massive scale that they will constantly drive down the price of AI and the quality up in AI that you would just get squeezed, you know, into such a difficult position that I'm not sure what your value proposition would be. Like we ran these tests on Gemma from 2 weeks ago and the new open source model from Google, and
yeah, not to be confused with the Severance character Gemma.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So we ran these tests and it actually performed only like a couple points worse than Gemini on our evals for accurate data extraction from enterprise documents and data. And so the fact that you have an open weights model from Google that is almost at par with their commercial model that was already kind of state of the art 2 or 3 months prior as a set of breakthroughs means that, like, you know, you're going to, as an enterprise, you're going to have a choice between an open weights model. You're going to have a choice between a commercial model. They're going to all perform extremely well. And you're really only going to be making a choice of like, do I want all of the scaffolding managed for me? Or do I want to just run this in my own data center or GPUs or my own cloud? But like, imagine being a kind of a complete standalone company trying to do that when you have, you know, Alphabet and Meta and, you know, Microsoft and then OpenAI and Anthropic and X, like everybody's doing that. I don't know how you'd sort of slip in there. So, you know, there's a case to be made for obviously an extreme, like deep vertical, you know, use case or some, you know, kind of niche, but I'm taking your question literally. I think you'd still eventually then need to build the software around it. You'd have to get really good at all of the technology that surrounds delivering that AI model to the customer in a way that lets them actually use it. as opposed to just selling tokens back and forth. I don't think there's a business model for a, you know, kind of an independent player at scale to just own kind of, you know, monetizing tokens.
If you were running OpenAI, would you keep pushing the boundaries of frontier models, or does that just feel like such diminishing returns, and why not redirect all that energy to the consumer product that is ChatGPT?
Yeah, I would definitely do it, and I don't have that much kind of critical feedback for OpenAI or kind of any of the major players at the moment. The areas of critical issue are, what does Google do about core search? Like, that's a super interesting question. What does Apple do about, kind of the Siri problem, and like, how much do they need to own themselves versus, kind of let other players, power some of that functionality. So, there's some interesting strategic questions that I think emerge, but in terms of OpenAI, their execution, I think it's exactly what probably I'd be doing, which is let's kind of, it's not even hedging your bets. There's a nice flywheel. So they're not like different work streams. It's like, let's have the best models in the world. Let's then incorporate that into a consumer and prosumer and then business set of products. And then there's now a new layer, which is like, let's make sure that we have like applied use cases in these agents, the rumored engineering agent and all this stuff. And so they can kind of, I think they can have their cake and eat it too in a lot of this. But it's critical that they are always at the forefront of the state of the art models, because that's the calling card into the business conversation, which is, we also have, the best performing models on these dimensions. And if there was only, the ChatGPT play, I'm not sure that would be, that is not why their brand got to where they are. And I think you want both those things to kind of be interlocked. Now, there was an interesting thought experiment that somebody mentioned recently, which was, for at least the consumer use case, if tomorrow you swapped in, Gemini or DeepSeek, just like, and just had a person go to ChatGPT, would they notice the difference? The answer is, obviously probably not at this point. Like, we've reached a convergence on model quality for most consumer use cases to be satisfied but most as in like, the majority, but not necessarily the most important ones. And so there's going to be an 80-20 rule, which is, we probably have solved like 80% of like, hey, what's the score to this sports game? Tell me about World War II. What should I wear in this meeting? We've solved that. But the 20% is going to still be like, orders of magnitude more quality that we need, which is like, go out and, do the classic, I need you to book a flight, type problem. And those, we're nowhere close to solving. So we kind of got to the 80% really quickly. And now the 20% is going to take years and years to kind of keep cranking through.
I get the feeling you're excited about agents, if I read your tweets and all that. Is there an agent that you think has product market fit today?
Yes. Couple things. Like, I think that I don't know if everybody's equally defining agents in the same way, but I'll give you like three or four. So, one company, that I happen to be an investor in, but I think they just independently, you'd probably agree, is this sort of space around outbound selling. So one company is 11X. I think there's others that are good. And they've tapped into, maybe the product market fit right now is like lead gen. And then it kind of expands from there. But for all intents and purposes, people are using this to augment, their sales capacity, generate more demand. That seems to be working. I think like writ large coding agents, seem to be working. Again, maybe we could define different levels of agenticness. But what you're seeing in, Cursor, Windsurf, Replit, Lovable Bolt, et cetera, like, obviously, probably different use cases, like probably 80% of the vibe coding is more fun and it's interesting to watch and not going into production. But I could see a lot of, product market fit for, hey, I have this internal IT tool. It's not, not the most strategic thing we have to do. I can have an agent kind of write it or modify it. And then boom, I've just like solved that problem that used to maybe go to low code tools, or you would have to like, you'd either never solve or you might hire a contract firm and it would take 6 months to go build. So I'd say that's product market fit. On our end, we have one of our first kind of agentic use cases in just the fact that it's not kind of a single, you know, one shot in the model, is just we extract data from documents. So then you can, you know, say, hey, here's a contract, here's an invoice. I want to, you know, read the document, put that into a database, and then automate a workflow around it. That's, you know, clearly got, at least in our world, product market fit. Like mostly our problem is we can't keep up with all the range of use cases customers want. And so like there's like more demand than the ability to kind of satisfy, you know, everything that the customers are asking for. But those are a few. On the consumer side, I'd say probably not a lot of PMF on agents. But on business, you know, it's, my bet was this 2 years ago. My bet will probably be it in 5 years from now. We're probably over-indexed on the flashiest parts of AI in the consumer world, and then under-indexed on the things that will just make, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in B2B. And I'm sure Nikita is like,
yeah. It's good. You're talking my book here.
So,
I guess one question, the business model of cloud, SaaS, yeah, if you will, I think has been historically probably underappreciated, versus, obviously the delivery mechanism and all that. I think people have a lot of appreciation for, but just purely, how the pricing was able to disrupt a lot of, things, be it Salesforce or whoever. I'm curious, do you think that usage pricing is an opportunity with AI to have that similar effect, or is it something different in your mind?
For the broad transformation or disruption, or which, on which axis?
Yeah, I guess as you think about like who your historical competitors were, I think historically people underestimated the on-prem to SaaS transition, and the number of customers you could reach,
yes,
was probably one of the big things.
Yes.
But there was a lot of innovation that ended up happening around seat-based pricing and elements of, you know, fair use pricing, like Slack was early in that. And I think all of, yeah, that stuff, there was a bunch of different elements of the SaaS transition, yeah, that ended up being, you know, user-based in some way, that I think was an accelerant of this transformation and transition that ended up playing out. I guess, do you think usage has a similar opportunity, yeah, for existing businesses, or is it a little orthogonal and ultimately it might not be as broadly applicable as?
I think it's very relevant. My characterization of SaaS and cloud, from a business model disruption, was it took something that you used to spend upfront, like maybe millions of dollars on, to now you spent thousands of dollars on.
And the CapEx to OpEx transition.
CapEx to OpEx, sort of like perpetual license to, you know, by the drip, you know, anything that was just like, okay, I have to wrap my head around this major outlay of capital, system integrator fees, infrastructure I have to build out, team, like, you know, this is more anecdotal, but if you were like to deploy a CRM system in the 90s, you know, just think about what had to go into that. Like data centers, system integration, you bought software for the CRM system, but you still had to buy hardware. You had to buy all the servers. You had to have a network. So like, think about how many steps from the moment you said, I want a CRM system, to the day that you're actually going to like log into it with your data, I don't know, a year, year and a half, you know, millions of dollars. Salesforce shows up and they're like, literally like tomorrow you can just have a CRM system. And oh, by the way, you could use it for 20 people in your company. And there's no, you don't need some kind of like critical mass to make the economics work, like just like start using it. And so, you know, you multiply that over two decades or two and a half decades, and it's like every SMB on the planet can do it. Every small team can do it. And the TAMs of these markets just basically grow because now everybody can afford a CRM system that couldn't. So that was, it was because it was a seat based, it was because it was subscription. It was also just because literally like your day one upfront bill was just a hundredth of what it would have been, you know, because you don't have all the other things, you know, wrapped around it. Cloud did the same thing, obviously more on an elastic basis with compute. So I think what agents do is that, I think there's going to be two big kind of areas of upside. One is you're doing that now for effectively a form of labor, And so that kind of has this interesting impact of it expands the TAM of software from only being able to sell the software to people on the other end. So you were kind of capped by the number of seats to now you have kind of like, you know, like I can think of categories where the category of AI agent spend will be an order of magnitude more than the spend of the software in a kind of a non-AI world. So take you know a you know relatively simple example of like contract management software. Contract management software as a category is like a couple billion dollars, like globally in the world. Legal services is a couple hundred billion dollar category. And so can software take, you know, 10% of that spend, you know, through AI to and pull from the legal services spend or expand the legal services spend? And then all of a sudden this category that was relatively niche couldn't make that much money because the amount of people that wanted to buy contract management software was kind of low. Could that now be a $20 billion category as opposed to a couple billion dollar category? So you could do that probably 20, 50 times across software and already underwrite massive TAM expansion after going after, you know, a whole bunch of new use cases that used to be, you know, kind of labor essentially. And then the other part is AI, you know, has a way of just completing the things that people have kind of always wanted to do in the products themselves, but just were never possible, which then also unlocks a whole bunch of new budget as well. So I think you're going to see this is the new version of disruption is it just will, it makes, you know, it lets you go and complete the outcome that the customer was looking for in a way that they are not required to go and deliver it themselves with their people. And then that means that you know, more than that value accrues to you. And so that's the usage-based or outcome pricing I think we're going to see in AI.
When you extrapolate that service budget there forward and think about the value to the end customer, totally makes sense that they'd be willing to pay. Hey, there was this person that I had to do this, and now I can get software to reach things that weren't even possible or do it more. I worry about the deflationary element a little bit of like the competition. And at the end of the day, are you beholden to what your next competitor is willing to charge? And so we might not be able to actually tap into the service budget quite as much, not because the opportunity is not there, but because there's tons of venture companies popping up and competing with one another. So I guess one, would love to get your reaction to that. Two, how do you think about durable value creation? Because I think everyone agrees, for example, Zoom, I would pay anything for it basically to work if there was no other alternative. But there's a lot of other alternatives. So there's an anchor on what I'm actually willing to pay.
Yeah. So I don't think that any law of market dynamics, you know, changes because of AI. But I would say that has probably been true in venture startup land kind of forever, which is, you know, the CRM, I bet there was a CRM market map from Gartner in 96 that was like 47 companies that did CRM, and somehow only Siebel and like one or two others made it to the other end. And so, you know, did they temporarily cause a deflationary impact on the price of maybe what Siebel could have charged if they were left alone? For sure. Did it still create a great, you know, outcome for Siebel? And, you know, there's a version of the world where it, you know, doesn't sell to Oracle and they, you know, pivot the company and now it's a, you know, $100 billion company. I guess it's 100% true, but nothing about AI seems to follow a different law of how these things play out, which is competition will suppress, you know, what you could like maximally charge, and it keeps kind of all the players in check. But eventually you get like some degree of network effects, some degree of like, you know, reference customers that tell each other, you know, that you can all use, you know, X thing and so on. And, you know, like just apropos the timing of this conversation, like my dad was asking like, how did Wiz get sold for, you know, $30 billion, and we're a Wiz customer. And I think the technology is fantastic. How does that happen in a world where like, obviously there's like 500 security startups, like, well, how does one break out? And there's a little flywheel where like your product's just 20% better, then you get a few more reference customers, and then you learn faster, and then you're product is another 20% better, faster, and then you get slightly better, you know, people working on it, and you kind of spins out, and then all of a sudden you have one with escape velocity, you know, outpacing the rest of the category. But yet probably there's still a second and third and fourth player that are pretty good, and they'll probably also grow, and then they'll get acquired. So I think AI, I mean, I don't see a different dynamic playing out in AI for any reason. And so then the things you probably want to do to like maximize your moats are, you know, again, the same lessons probably from 35 years ago in enterprise software, which is, you know, get data, do workflows, you know, make sure you've got a, you know, kind of enough happening within your ecosystem that keeps customers to have some kind of, there's like a compounding value, the more data that comes into the system, you know, the next run of the AI agent, you know, gets just a little bit smarter. You know, there's going to be a lot of network effects on the embeddings of your data. So you could, as a single programmer, you could probably switch between Cursor, Windsurf, and, you know, Replit and a few others. But as a network of 500 engineers in a company, and I've done embeddings on the whole code base, and I'm talking to all the different, you know, systems it's wired up to, wow, change management on that, you know, becomes a lot harder. So I think we're going to see a lot of very similar, you know, maybe this will be bad news for everybody in AI, but it's going to look a lot like SaaS, and the lessons are going to look like a lot like SaaS. And so you want data, you want workflows, you want strong customer references, and you want to build a network effect around your customers. And I think it's going to play out like that. And then maybe the one thing that we just have to be prepared for is there might be some pricing dynamics right now in play in AI that won't necessarily last forever, which is like, right now you can kind of comp it to labor in some areas. And that probably feels like a little bit of a temporary advantage that you might have, when ultimately it'll probably be more comp to like typical software margin structures. And that'll just be a journey that, you know, the industry goes through as we kind of land to the, you know, terminal business model.
Yeah, I guess we don't need to belabor this point. The two things that I do wonder about with AI specifically are the solutions that are maybe less workflow UI centric. In some ways, there's like the SaaS world. Traditionally, we had all these screens and logins and, you know, the workflow that existed on top. And so maybe security in that way is actually the right analogy, because there's definitely dashboards and integration points and all that with security. But ultimately, the work is getting done oftentimes outside of those screens, right? It's pulling in all the data in some ways. And so, it's just something we've been noodling internally.
And what do you conclude because of that?
I think the things that are just tapping into the work automation, be it customer support or SDR or whatever it is, ultimately, because there's less workflow embedded into it, the change from one to the next, I think there's less friction associated with that change. And so you can swap it out. You see, it's almost like a meme on the internet of people going from, you know, Cursor to Codeium or whatever it is. And that's not the right analogy, because that actually has some workflow around it. But it does feel like people are a little more willing to switch than at least I had historically experienced. In truth, what's the difference between Asana and Monday and Trello or whatever? Well, the difference is like, you got to switch your entire team onto something different in a meaningful way, versus when the work is actually being done outside of the UI, it might just be one click change, which just leads to a little bit, more ability to price shop, more ability to do other stuff. But I guess that it ties back to the integration, similar to security.
So that's the thing. So the question is, so it used to be the network, the stickiness was I had 100 people that all learned how to use the buttons, and then there was data behind the buttons. And so, man, that's a lot of change. But the question would be like, is there going to be an analogy where, you know, it's inverted, where it's APIs, it's the APIs into your other systems, it's the APIs into your e-commerce thing. It's then the logic around when to make the decision about the e-commerce thing. So I think...
And it's self-reinforcing and learning, right? And so like at some extent, you get all the data, get all the integrations, but then there's ultimately some algorithm or whatever, some AI thing on top that's learned on top of itself. Yeah. So sure, you could switch, but then it's a cold start to start over.
Because I could underwrite the exact opposite of this point, which is that when you have a learning system, that learning system will probably perform better than your people did. And so previously you could change out, you could swap out software, and there wasn't like so much IP in the heads of the people about how that software worked. Cause we're just like, okay, click the next button and whatever. But like the AI is going to track every event it's done in history and, you know, and just get a little bit better. And the signal will just get a little bit better and it'll, you know, have a little bit more fine tuning, or it'll have a little bit better instructions to the model. And then that becomes some, you know, opaque, you know, data source to you, the customer, that is inside this, you know, AI product that just makes the thing always perform 5 or 10% better in a way where you can't just go to people and say, here's the new sheet of paper for how to use this new product we just implemented. Like you almost have now created your own, you know, for all intents and purposes, model for doing customer support or coding in your product. So the more black box or obfuscated or non-UI oriented it is, to me, doesn't necessarily correlate to its stickiness. And in fact, maybe it could be the opposite.
Hmm. I heard you say that cloud was pure efficiency. And maybe there goes back to one talk you were giving at some big bank that everyone's eyes were glazing over. I think it was like a conference or something that maybe the most boring or least interested you've had a crowd. But it wasn't like tangibly output based in some way that like the rank and file within an organization didn't care about the back end infrastructure. And ultimately, you're speaking about some elements of it. Can you give that quick anecdote, but then also talk about how AI is different and how that translates to the enterprise and the conversations you're having?
Yeah. So if I recall the anecdote properly, it was I think I was just referencing that like in the peak of cloud adoption, I did this keynote on like the future of you know running your bank or you know financial services, and it was mostly just to pitch cloud, and it was you know I found it very exciting, but the audience didn't because it was just like yep cool we get it man, like the servers are not in our data center anymore, they're in now a cloud data center, like really like super cool, and so that to me was kind of it kind of captured the cloud transition, you know, at an industry level in a nutshell, which was like, it made your IT operations faster. It meant you could store more data so you could make better decisions. It makes your employees more efficient because they have better software, but it didn't radically transform like entire industries or sectors. And AI, you know, conversely has the opportunity to actually radically transform how you run your business, how you make decisions, you know, how you serve your customers, how you build products. And, you know, I think it's always useful to learn, you know, figure out like what things will be similar to a prior technical, you know, technology transition, which things will be different. I think the thing that will be similar is that adopting AI versus cloud will take all the same change management. It'll take all the same meetings. It'll take all of the same, you know, privacy and policy and governance and compliance review people. Everybody like it's going to be all of that, but I do notice and see one big distinction in the two waves, having kind of been at the similar time frames for both. In the very early days of cloud, you would go into a meeting with a bank, a pharma, a government agency, and you'd say, you know, I'd love to talk to you about, you know, moving your data to the cloud, and it was sort of like not interested, shock, like definitely not going to happen, not going to happen here. Maybe there'll be some small little workload that's like a dev test workload. Maybe some, you know, department or fringe, you know, group will use it. And so it was mostly like years and years of just like selling and selling and selling and trying to get you to understand what was so much better and all of this. Conversely, and so we're only about 2.5 years into ChatGPT, let's say. So that would easily describe 2.5 years into cloud if I go back to the late 2000s, let's say. If I look at AI right now, that exact same meeting with a customer or set of peer customers is like we know this is going to change everything. Everybody's clamoring for it. Every employee needs it. The new generation coming into the workforce is asking for it. My boss is asking for it. The board is asking for it. I need to figure out a strategy. And like it's not when, it's how. It's not if, it's when, it's how. It's like what can we do? I need to do more yesterday. And so totally different universes. So basically what that means is that you've bypassed all of the normal like resistance to this happening that normally, you know, happens with one of these big changes. And now it's purely in the mode of like, how do we make it happen? Which functions are going to use it? What is the impact to, you know, how do we make decisions when an AI generated the response? How much human in the loop do we need? So we've jumped all into just now that mode, 5 to 7 years faster than we did with cloud. Now, that doesn't mean that the adoption will follow a different trajectory, because again, it's really people, it's change management, it's systems, but the reluctance and emotional kind of consternation is very different this time.
And so what is the resistance when you're going into the organization, or how would you describe beyond the enthusiasm and trying to figure out the how and the when, like what are the long poles in the tent? How much are on these organizations versus how much are on the commercial vendors?
Yeah, I'd say actually the maybe also this might abuse the analogy too much, but if I compare to cloud could do more than what customers were asking for because they were resisting it. So you could have always implemented cloud 50% more than you actually were at the time, or you know, hundreds of percent more. Maybe actually the reverse is true, which is I'd say most conversations now, the customer is actually like, they're jumping like three steps ahead once they see the demo and they're like, oh, that's great. Like, we'll just like totally automate that entire thing. And you're like, okay, well, let's, your data is not yet in the environment that it's going to need to be to do that use case. Or, you know, we're still waiting on some reasoning model breakthroughs from, you know, OpenAI or Claude or something to like, just get that extra 3% of accuracy that you're going to need. So in this case, I think customers have pretty much jumped ahead to way closer to the end state, which is like, yeah, great. Like, let's give all the employees a productivity boost. Let's figure out where we can deploy agents to the organization. Now, you know, I want to do a massive asterisk. I'm talking to the people that are talking to us, which means that, like, by definition, they're leaning in. They're a little bit more forward thinking. So some of the anecdotes I'm sharing are from those types of customers. I think there's still an 80% of customers that are like, whoa, like my head's exploding. Where should I start? Where should I go first? But there are a lot of customers where they're now ahead of the technology based on the set of use cases that they have. And so I wouldn't say it's like the hurdles, unfortunately, are much more like practical considerations. Like literally, like I can't just, you know, turn on an AI thing that looks at all my data and then an employee can ask a question, because guess what? It's all of a sudden going to reveal, you know, secrets in the organization that they shouldn't have had access to, but they were over provisioned for access like 5 years ago. Or, hey, you know, AI agents are really good at doing code, you know, auto completion, but like, am I ready to put an AI agent in production for like generating a full, you know, multi-file, you know, output? And then how do I review that when the human actually wasn't along the ride for the actual, you know, editing process? Are they going to really understand the code? Are they allowed to press submit and that goes into production? Like that's going to be these are like the big questions that people are dealing with. I mean, imagine how unhinged we are online, where we're like, oh man, we just made a video game in three hours, and it's like, and it does all this stuff, and then you're like, you're an engineer in like a banking system. Like, are you supposed to go implement that right now? Like, is that like, are we ready for like your bank account to be, you know, driven by vibe coding? Like, we don't know. So these are the kind of things that I think every enterprise is trying to figure out, like, okay, so what pace should I implement this stuff? You know, is my data ready? Are my systems ready? A lot of it is about, wow, the industry is moving so fast. How do I make, ironically, the industry is moving so fast. How do I make decisions right now that I'm going to be stuck with in a fast changing space? So a lot of it is actually like, can you get your architecture set up for like optionality in the future? Because maybe the vendor you work with today is not going to be the one that's the best in the future. You need to be able to swap out different parts. These are the kind of conversations that we have.
To that end, you cautioned, I forget if it was a blog post or a tweet or something, but that being early to AI in some ways can be a liability if you don't set up the architecture with the right abstractions. Yeah. In some ways. I guess as you think about the applicability of this for Box as a as an organization, and therefore the advice you might have for others. How do you think about being flexible with this pace of change? And is it more about being model agnostic or modular in elements of the design? What would you share on that?
Yeah, all the above. So there's how we build and then how we even implement AI internally. How we build is basically we try and figure out the parts of the stack that there's probably a few different categories, and I'm making up some of the maybe the nomenclature on the fly, but like there'll be parts of the stack that just like will never change. A model breakthrough will happen and it doesn't matter. Like we're not going to change that particular interface, you know, with our system. So that you can just like lock and load and start executing. There's other parts where you're like, we think there's a best in class technology now, you know, maybe we're kind of like, we're shaky on it. We probably prefer there to be an open source version. So that's a spot where you probably need to be really thoughtful about, you know, how much do you lean into a particular, you know, part of the architecture. I'm thinking like, you know, your vector search, your RAG, execution, you know, these are spaces where there's a bunch of first movers, you know, people started adopting them. It's not exactly clear where it all ends up in 5 years from now. So you kind of want to be, you know, thoughtful about that. And then there's the final part on your modular point, which is like, you know, this space is changing every 3 minutes. You need to decide, do you want like maximum flexibility? So these are the model providers. Do you want to be able to have a way of you know, swapping in different parts? There's multiple parts of Box where we use multiple model providers for the same workflow. And so you just need to then have like a high degree of optionality, a high degree of flexibility in that part of the stack. And then you have different like abstraction layers between those different interfaces. But I think basically anybody in AI at this point has been building with that pattern. You know, you go to Perplexity, you change your model, you go to Cursor, you change your model. I think we're all realizing like, okay, you probably want to let the user change their model, or at least you as the developer have some degree of optionality there, because we know how fast that space moves. And then you have to decide like which other parts of the stack do you just kind of, you know, lock in on and don't worry about again.
Klarna, Sebastian, who we've had on before, and a good guy, great CEO, has been, I think he tweeted something recently. I think he accidentally made news in his telling of like consolidating SaaS vendors and moving more things to agentic workflow. And I'll tell you, it set off a little bit of a firestorm internally to see if this is like a, you know, a long-term thing that we need to be existentially worried about investing in software, because there was going to agentic workflows and systems were just going to do away with the need for the interface, and therefore everything could be in a CRUD database in some ways. I'm curious your perspective on that as we zoom out, and maybe is what they're doing, you think, broadly applicable to other organizations, or is this a one of one, maybe exceptional case that they're testing something and on the early frontier?
Yeah, I found it very fascinating, and I enjoyed that it was happening, and I enjoy that it's still theoretically happening. I think some of his updates were that like they didn't actually do as much on the customer support side, or they have some more, you know, kind of premium agent, human agents that they now have. But I thought it was great from a provocativeness standpoint. I think we do need people testing the boundaries. I think it's the kind of thing which is, it didn't cause me to rethink all of SaaS because I don't remember the first time I heard this, but maybe it was like 15 years ago or something. I was meeting with an IT, you know, leader at Tesla, and they were like building, I'm going to make up 80% of the story, but they were building their own ERP system. And I was like, holy crap, I cannot believe that you're doing this. And like, maybe this is the future. And then you like quickly wake up that like, okay, like, no, like, you know, this is sort of an Elon special where he needed to control end to end the whole thing. And they needed their own, you know, they didn't want any of the off the shelf stuff. And the amount of fortitude and just, you know, sheer entrepreneurialness you need to have to even want to attempt that is like kind of insane. And so I think the Klarna example is more in that category. Like it's just like, if you go to the average company and you're like, do you want to be responsible for running your own HR system? Like the average enterprise is not going to say yes to that. And no matter how agentic, you know, something is, it does mean that you're responsible for the thing. Like this, the AI provider that has made the agent that wrote your HR system is not taking responsibility for the HR system code that was generated. So that means by definition, you, the customer, are now responsible for whatever the thing is that it produced. It's not going to be the AI models. You know, Claude is not, Anthropic is not taking any responsibility for how your HR system works. And if it leaks data and you get sued by the EU because there's some kind of, you know, data privacy thing, like that's not Claude. Like that's Workday. Workday will do that, not Anthropic. So I think you'd have to be like, you know, which parts of software are people so unhappy about that they would do themselves, or which parts of software just like are so needed to be customized, or which parts of software are so unstrategic that you don't mind whipping up these like micro apps for like one-off things. And so you don't, you're fine that it is built by this, you know, an agent that you can just deploy quickly and turn it off. And it's kind of, you know, it's a 3-month, you know, it needs to live in the world for only 3 months. Those for the foreseeable future, next 2 years, let's say, that would be the only thing I think could be disrupted. But I don't think your HR system is going away. I don't think your CRM system is going away. I don't think that really changes. To your point about deflationary impact, I do think that there's a chance that you could see, you know, you could see a new crop of like, I'm going to just like YOLO it and build like the AI, you know, like I'm going to build Oracle with AI agents and just like give it a shot. But that would still be a software company that emerges from that. And you're really using AI purely to just, you know, add engineering augmentation. I don't think the customer wants to be responsible for that software at the end of the day.
That was my conclusion as well, yeah. Which I think is good for people investing in software companies.
Now, big asterisk, like in 10 years, do I want to, you know, be on the record as saying this? I mean, like, let's see. But just, I just don't think companies want to be responsible for every problem in the world. Jeffrey Moore came up with this idea. I think it was Jeffrey Moore that came up with it, but maybe he credited somebody else, of core versus context. And like context is just like shit that like you just want done for you. You don't want to worry about it. Core obviously being like, this is like existential to my business. And for most people, like their core business is not their HR system. And so thus you hire other people to do your HR system. And so that's why you don't really want, you know, you don't want your internal IT team being responsible for rebuilding something that you can get off the shelf and just it's done for you.
That's the way I feel whenever technical founders want to reinvent sales comp. And it's just like, you're not, it's hard enough to differentiate on one vector. You know, this isn't going to be like the make or break. We can go through all the books and talk about it. All right, I'm going to give you some quick ones and you give me your gut reaction on some of these things. Ready? Do you think the net of AI in some reasonable period of time, maybe 5 to 10 years, decreases the number of hours worked by your average knowledge worker?
Well, how many years?
5 to 10.
God, I'm gonna stick with no for now.
Yeah, I think I agree. Do you think AI will flatten org structures in any meaningful way? Example, fewer middle managers, faster approval, more self-service, knowledge work?
This one I could buy. I could buy. I think actually layers have gotten pretty crazy over the past couple decades. I think yes. And part of it is because I think that AI kind of lets you, it lets functions, my latest kind of conclusion is that it kind of lets functions sometimes do their adjacent function. And so it lets the designer write the AI, the front end code. It lets the back end developer write the front end, you know, code. It lets the copywriter, you know, generate the full white paper. So I think what that means is that you will have sort of more full stack workers almost. Like we don't really think about this outside of engineering, but I think you'll probably, I think we've gotten like maybe overly disciplined in job functions. In some parts of of the economy. And I think AI kind of lets you have a little bit more expansive responsibility. So then that probably means that that's a little bit of a flattening when you don't have to hop through and around as many orgs to get things done. So, but we'll see.
Did you ever read the David Epstein book Range, Why Generalists Triumph?
No. Would it relate to this?
Okay. Yeah, kind of. It sort of talks about, like, they give the example of Roger Federer growing up and playing multiple sports versus Tiger Woods being specialized in one, and how many breakthroughs in society have occurred from people outside of a core field or domain, leveraging the knowledge they have in that and going into another one. And so it goes through scientific breakthroughs or company foundings or all this, where when you get too verticalized in some ways, you just don't have the context of the way other people do things. And so oftentimes breakthroughs come outside.
I think work has probably gotten like a little bit too Adam Smith. And we've like, you know, we're all just doing our little part of the paperclip factory or whatever the, you know, or the needle, I think it was needle factory or.
Yeah. The paperclip. We've all Aaron Ross or whatever, predictable revenue. We've done that across every element of society at this point.
So I think probably AI relieves us a little bit of that. Like division of labor, maybe got just a little bit too granular over time. And so I think maybe we get a little bit of a chance of a reset, which is like, no, I can like just throw a little bit more of a general problem at somebody, and they've got the ability to kind of go and fully solve it, which frankly I think is a huge, hugely exciting thing and much more fulfilling probably for the knowledge worker kind of class that I think has a lot of upside.
What's the coolest or most mind-blowing demo you've seen in the last, call it 3 to 6 months, where you were like, wow, I can't believe that's actually possible that we can do this?
Yeah. I'm having a funny journey because you do start to now, unfortunately, like build such high tolerance and desensitization.
It's like the hedonic treadmill in some ways, right? You're just like, I always reference now with AI, the Louis C.K. bit about like airplane and Wi-Fi. And you're just like, you're flying through the sky, like, and you have access to the internet. And that's the way I feel about a lot of the AI things where, you know, deep research like hallucinates a little bit. And I'm like, oh, this is bullshit. Like,
it only saved me 7 hours.
Exactly. Was that 15 hours of work you would have done otherwise prepping for this interview? Like, yes, you know.
Yeah. So it's tough because I wish I could have my pre ChatGPT like wiring for every individual breakthrough, because I think I would just be like, holy shit, this thing is witchcraft, like every day. Like I remember like yelling at a friend who was like deep in LLMs, like, you know, a week into ChatGPT, and I was like, I'm sorry, I literally don't understand. How did it write the business strategy on a thing it's never scanned from the internet? And like, I was just like, obviously an idiot at that point on all this stuff. And like, but I want that like energy again, where I'm just like surprised by everything. So I think from a pure utilitarian standpoint, I still love the, you know, it's the exact example you just did, which is I try and force myself as many times as possible to be like, okay, deep research exists. Like don't do the thing where you open 7 tabs and you go through all this stuff. It's just like, just send the query, go back to it. I had a thing 48 hours ago. It saved me an hour and a half. But I had to catch myself, cause I was like about to just go to do my research, my normal, like, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. You know, I know how to research things. Did deep research, and lo and behold, like, as far as I could tell, no hallucination. I checked a couple of the answers. Fantastic, because it just like, boom, solved the problem for me. Like, so, you know, I'm now doing that probably 5 to 10 times a week on something, which is just an awesome productivity boost. I'm still probably incrementally surprised by and excited by front end design creation with AI. So, you know, I'll pop in a screenshot into Cursor and it codes it, or I'll pop in a prompt into, you know, V0 Replit, and it produces something that I would have like had to ping an engineer or a designer about and be like, can you go work on this? And so like, you know, unfortunately, like my browser history kind of looks a little unhinged, because it's like 11:30 PM on Saturday. I'm like on on V0 doing designs. So that still is pretty exciting, I think, to me.
Yeah. What do you think is more likely to be impactful in the enterprise for AI? Multimodal capabilities like image, text, code, voice, or the agentic workflows that we kind of talked about earlier?
If you have perfectly executing agentic workflows, that's the holy grail. So the amount of the, you know, my workshop analogy is like, in data science as an example, and anything obviously that you put into a structured database, we've always had this ability to be like, okay, I'm going to go compute some large set of things, like go run the analysis on this customer base in this region to do a thing. And like, we used to, we still do, but we would talk about it like, okay, I have a job running and I'm going to, I'll check back in an hour and figure out what the answer was. Like, imagine in all forms of unstructured knowledge work, a world where you just have jobs running, where you're just like, I just sent these 10 agents to go and like figure out and synthesize all of this clinical drug trial research to give me insights. Like, we were only wired to think about sending off jobs and compute tasks for like 3% of all corporate work. Now imagine if you do that for the other 97%, or at least 80% of the 90%. And you're just like, yeah, like I send out a job to go research this new region I want to enter as a business. I send out a job to go and figure out what all of my, product feedback was, and then build me a roadmap that I should go look at and decide if it's, validated or right. Like it's just going to be crazy when you can actually do full agentic workflows, whether it's deep research or executing a task or, automating a customer experience. That continues to probably be the biggest area of upside. Hmm.
2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Do you think the best model in those periods will be closed source, proprietary, or open source? Maybe go through each. Like, in 2 years, you say closed source or open source?
I think for lack of having any imagination on this, I think that I would mostly be in the camp of it almost doesn't matter, because within 3 months of the breakthrough, you'll have an open source version. So I think it's kind of doesn't matter whether the open source version did it first, China did it, or that OpenAI did it, because I think within 3 months we can expect that you'll have the open source version of the closed source breakthrough. So then almost by definition, you can almost still expect then a large amount of the traffic and the use will be open source, because you're not trading off that much, because you'll still get the open weight version of what just emerged.
What's the most exciting Box AI feature, application, workflow that you've rolled out that you think is underappreciated by your existing user base and everyone should really be thinking more about adopting?
There's two features we're most excited about. The first is we have this product called Hubs, and what Hubs does is, if you go to Box and you go to any file system, you create a folder, you put files in the folder, you share that with people. You have this problem, which is, folders are kind of like unintuitive for the recipient, because they're like, I don't know, like which third subfolder down did you put the sales material that I'm looking for to use for my customer pitch. So we created Hubs, which is an overlay onto folders. So you can put as many of your files and folders into a hub, and then you can go and just ask questions of the hub. And so this solved actually a very, very nuanced, highly important thing, which was, if you go to a general purpose, just AI chat window, you have to do a lot of work to guess what stuff is on the other end of this chat window. If you go to a hub, in our case, you kind of know by hub, what does it have access to? So we have a sales hub, which means by definition that has all the sales information. We have an HR hub, which means that it has all your HR information. So you go to the HR hub and you ask the HR question, and then we're basically doing RAG on your documents for all of your HR documents. And we're doing RAG on all your sales, presentations. We're doing RAG on all your customer support product documentation. So that basically gives you these micro knowledge portals for every topic that you want. And so that's a game changer because you just, again, the user instantly knows what topic is going to be covered in this thing. So you dramatically reduce the hallucination. You dramatically increase the authoritative content that will be in the hub. So that's pretty cool. And then the final one that is just working out kind of way better than we had hoped initially, like, you know, a year and a half ago, let's say, is just AI data extraction from documents. It sounds like way too straightforward for anybody listening, but it's insanely powerful if all your job is like review contracts, review invoices, pull out data from resumes, you know, standardize my financial reporting documentation. We could just now automate, you know, basically most of that.
That's great. Well, Aaron, thanks for doing this. I think we covered a lot of ground, so really appreciate you being in there.
Thank you, Logan. Good luck on the valuations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good.